We have two presenters today, and it'll be a three-part presentation with Mark starting out and Greg presenting next, and then Mark finishing up. The two presenters, Dr. Mark Cram, he's the founder and president of Groundswell Technologies. He specializes in automated monitoring and modeling of environmental and homeland security sensor networks. He earned his PhD in environmental science and management from the University of California at Santa Barbara. He has an MS degree in geology and a BS in chemistry from the University of California, Santa Barbara. He has 20 years of experience using innovative environmental assessment techniques. He's been instrumental in the areas of sensor development and implementation, innovative GIS applications, de-ample site characterization, chemical field screening, and monitoring well design. Most recently, Mark served as the technical lead on DOD's ESTCP direct push well comparison project, and he was also the principal investigator on the ESTCP high resolution PISA cone project that he also gave a seminar on August 27th here on the Kluin Studio, which as of this morning you can now go to the Kluin Studio archives and view if you missed it or just want to listen to it again. He's also a member, an active member, of the National Groundwater Association. He's been a part of ASTM International Standards Development. He's on an ITRC team, and he's our next speaker is Greg Gustafson. He's founder and president of Instrument Northwest, an environmental instrumentation manufacturer in Kirkland, Washington. Greg has been designing and manufacturing environmental data collection tools and systems since 1982, including simple deep water sampling pumps, portable and dedicated sampling systems, submersible pressure transmitters, water quality sensors, smart sensors, and wireless data collection systems. Greg promotes new technologies and sound data collection practices. He is a member of the sampling and characterization team on the ITRC and is a member of the National Groundwater Association. With that, if the audience would please remember, put your phones on mute. And, guys, you can take it away. Mark?
Thank you very much, and thank you to everybody that's here. I greatly appreciate your time, and I hope that this will be an engaging opportunity for everybody involved. I'd like to just start by maybe on a philosophical note here. As you can see from the title, we're trying to merge several concepts here that may not have been merged that often in the recent past. When I think of triad, I often think of expedited site characterization. This will hopefully be an entree into an extension of that concept to essentially use expedited approaches for many components involved in the history of a site. So with that, I'd like to go to slide 1.2. The objectives are as follows. We want to talk about some optimized characterization techniques that many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with. Integrate that with some remediation design concepts and framework, and then actually apply some expedited long-term monitoring applications to some of these stated intentions. So taking triad to the next level is comprised of developing that conceptual site model and then utilizing that model in your remediation and monitoring strategy. And then, as I mentioned, the integration of these components to try to streamline the entire process. Ultimately, for those of you who've seen some of the other efforts I've been involved with, I'd like to work towards a single mobilization solution where we take best-of-class technologies, and before we leave the site, we've got a nice conceptual and even an analytical model of both the chemical distribution as well as the hydraulic distribution, hydraulic parameter distributions. We've got a model. We've got an idea about how we want to design a long-term monitoring system, and then we actually implement that system, install it. So that's sort of a broad brush stroke of what we'd like to accomplish here. Next slide, 1-3. So I'm going to talk about some best of class direct push characterization techniques. For time sake, I'm not going to be able to cover everything that I like out there. There's a tremendous amount of great work going on, as everybody knows here. So I'll touch upon a few that I think will meet our primary objectives, and some that I believe most people here are at least familiar with. Maybe some folks hopefully will learn about a couple new technologies that have recently become available. But in particular, we're going to focus on chemical distributions using some of these best-of-class direct push tools, some hydraulic parameter distributions, generation of models, in particular, flux model, which is, I'll go into more detail in a bit. I know a lot of folks are familiar with that, and it's becoming a concept du jour, if you will, among many leading practitioners, so I'll talk a little bit about that. Once you've got that, you design your long-term monitoring network, and I'll talk about what you might want to consider in doing so, and then some well-designed techniques, both conventional as well as a few new tricks that we've recently developed. And then I'll talk a little bit about sensor technologies, but Greg will really carry the bulk of that component of the presentation. And then we'll talk about some new long-term monitoring approaches that kind of bring everything together with respect to updating that conceptualization on the fly. If you want some additional information, I've put a link down below to some of the direct push technologies that will be discussed here. Again, since we're talking about direct push, some of the limitations that you might anticipate include lithology. So we're primarily talking about areas where you've got unconsolidated subsurface materials. 1-4. Let's stand back for a second and maybe look at where we've been. This is an example that was provided to me of the Massachusetts Military Reserve. There are at least 15 TCE plumes here, and if you look at the scale on the lower right, you can see that they're quite substantial in size, and there are obviously some cantankerous elements associated with release of some of these DNAPL types of materials, in particular TCE. Slide 1-5. At that one facility, they've had some large and dilute TCE plumes. A lot of people are calling them LND plumes. As you saw in that image before, some plumes are actually much greater than 2 miles long. And for the last 10 to 15 years, most of them have been contained using pump and treat. They've spent a significant amount of money on both the assessment and now the pump and treat and some other more innovative technologies. But that's a formidable price tag, as you can tell. And we're not done yet. We're maybe halfway through, based on some of the estimates I've seen. Currently, they're looking at 12 plumes that require remediation, but at least even after remediation, there's going to be some component of long-term monitoring to demonstrate lines of evidence that your remediation is actually accomplishing your goals. 1-6. I'd like to come back to this concept of flux a number of times through the presentation. All of us, I'm sure, are familiar with Darcy's law and how we derive seepage velocity. This is probably the most simplest form of seepage velocity equation. In our models, we get quite detailed in our matrices, but for sake of time, essentially the seepage velocity equation we're using here includes hydraulic conductivity, the hydraulic gradient, and the effective porosity related as such. Now, contaminant flux, which is just a relatively minor extension of that, is essentially the velocity times the concentration at any point. And that gives you a really nice feel for the amount of material that's loading. And what I mean by that is releasing to the aquifer and moving. And that's really, it represents a paradigm shift in how we prioritize what our approaches are going to be in terms of remediation. And I think this will become a little more clear after we talk about the next slide, 1-7. So here we're illustrating concentration versus flux. And I'd like to thank Carl Enfield for this graphic. I've used it many, many times, and I think it's one of the best graphics I could find on this concept. Essentially, the colors here on this plastic wedge illustrate concentration. So red is high concentration, blue is the low concentration. Now, the length of the vector represents flux. They're using J here. I was using F in the previous slide. But essentially, the length of the vector is proportional to the amount of flux. So there's a hydraulic component that gets merged with a chemical component here to derive this. So let's look under the letter A in that control plane, that source control plane, just down gradient from the release. You see in the red zone where there's high concentration, you also see a formidable vector length, implying that there's a lot of loading going on. There's a lot of flux. So both the velocity is formidable as well as the concentration. If you look under the A prime on the other part of the source control plane, you see that the vector is smaller. Well, there's a high concentration, but the vector is small because it could be in a silt or a clay. So we're actually incorporating our understanding of the lithology into our interpretation, which I think is essential. Some of these other areas along that plane really keep me up at night because you can see that if you were looking at concentration alone, you might miss some areas where significant risk is really prevalent. So, for instance, just above the B prime, you see a very large vector implying a lot of movement of mass, but the concentration is relatively low. So let's go to 1-8. So high concentration does not always imply high risk. And therefore, it's essential that we characterize the concentration distribution as well as the distribution of velocity that's based on these hydraulic components. Hopefully that's clear. 1-9. So what I'm going to talk about as a general framework is what, for lack of a better term, I would refer to as a streamlined or maybe an optimized approach for getting to the point that you, where you have a conceptual site model, but also an analytical model that's flux-based. So, and then you've also established, based on that model, a network for long-term monitoring. Regardless of your remediation option, it could be monitored natural attenuation or something more aggressive, you're going to want to have a monitoring system that's appropriately designed to capture and monitor this flux distribution. So the first component would obviously be plume delineation. And I'll talk about a couple of tools that I like, the membrane interface probe, laser-induced fluorescence, cone zipper for collecting samples, perhaps a field analytical laboratory. I'll talk about a few others as well. And you derive these two- and three-dimensional concentration distributions. And since you're using the cone penetrometer testing equipment, quite often you can get lithological information, and you may even be able to get enough information to design wells, which overlaps with your long-term monitoring network design. There's going to have to be a hydraulic assessment. And I'm going to talk about a couple different approaches. One is the high-resolution PISA cone that I'll dive into a little deeper in a few slides. And then also you could use conventional approaches, monitoring wells, aquifer tests, etc. But we definitely need to integrate that type of information much more deeply into that conceptual site model than maybe we've previously done in the past. And then, as I mentioned, you could actually, before you're done with your deployment, establish a long-term monitoring network. So you would utilize approaches for designing wells. I'm going to talk about two different methods. One, WDS, is a well-designed software system that I developed with Jeff Farr from the Bureau of Reclamation. It's based on CPT data, soil type data. But by all means, use of grain size distribution through ASTM 5092 is most appropriate, although I don't see it practiced as well as often as I'd like, which is one of the reasons why Jeff and I derived WDS. And then you would install these wells, and I prefer short screen wells, clusters of these, to get the third dimension. You'd obviously survey these locations, and then you'd run interpolations of these through several different packages are available, but the one that I've been using most often and we developed the new flux component for with Norm Jones at BYU is GMS, the groundwater modeling system. So we can run the interpolations and generate the velocity, the seepage velocity, and the flux distributions and have initial models. And then those models can be updated as you collect additional information throughout the history of the monitoring of your remediation approach. 110. When you design an approach for long-term monitoring, obviously you want to have a purpose for every data point. And every sample should have a reason for existing and for being collected. We are all familiar with receiving laboratory results, one-inch thick documents where the majority was non-detect. Well, maybe that's good if you're looking at establishing a background geochemical condition or maybe a down gradient extent or lateral extent of the contaminant. But obviously, we don't want to waste a lot of our time. And I think that's one of the reasons why Triad came to fruition is because we were seeing this type of result. So really, you want to understand the shape of the plume, the distribution of the plume, and not just in 2D, but three dimensions. So in 111 also, I add a few additional locations. So say for a typical plume, you may be able to get away with, 10 to 15 locations with specific goals in mind for those sentry wells or the wells that are monitoring the NAPL source area or the solute distribution and changes over time. Again, that's in map view. So you would probably multiply that by two or three if you wanted to do three dimensions. 112. One of the workhorses that everybody, I'm sure, online is familiar with is the cone penetrometer. Many variations of this exist. You've got several different types of push rigs, some very small, some very large. This is about our 20-ton truck, but we had a 30-ton truck when I used to work for the Department of Defense there. That was the original SCAP system. The beauty of this is that you can perform expedited site characterizations. You can have a dynamic work plan where you're essentially trying to meet an objective that's not based on number of samples, but based really on your goal for containing and constraining your understanding of the distribution of the chemical release as well as hydrologic elements associated with that. And the beauty of this type of technology is that you can get soil type, chemistry, you can collect samples, install wells, you can inject materials, amendments, etc. So it's a very, very useful tool. 113, please. Now, the first set of chemical characterization tools that I'll talk about includes the fluorescent probes. So there are several types of these fluorescence probes. Some have lasers above ground. Some include lamps below in the probe themselves. And I won't go into all the nuances of why certain designs might be better than others for different cases, but if you'd like to learn more, by all means, get a hold of me. I actually did quite a bit of work comparing all the variations on these types of systems. But essentially, you're employing light to excite the materials in the subsurface, and then you get that signal back instantaneously at the surface. So you know exactly where you got your quote-unquote hit of a fluorescent zone. And the fluorescent zone typically indicates where you have polyaromatic hydrocarbons. So it's great for fuel types of releases, petroleum-based releases. But we've also had quite a bit of success using this for Dean apples when you had commingled situations. So if the Dean apple was mixed somehow with a cutting oil or a grease, often those materials can act as a tracer. So it's a very powerful tool. And the nice thing also about this type of tool is that you can couple it with additional sensors. So you can get an idea of the lithology, and you can maybe even couple it with some sampling devices as well. I've seen some very creative folks out there where they have multiple sensors, and this is one of them that would be on the string, on the sounding rod. 114. Here's an example of how data can be represented. This is a push log where we superimpose soil type in the colored bands over the laser-induced fluorescence intensity. So the intensity is relatively related to the magnitude of the insult, and then the colors are associated with the soil type. So it's obviously very helpful conceptually to have this type of information, especially since you're collecting this information on a centimeter scale resolution for many of these types of probes. Now when you take a whole set of these in a grid formation, you can generate three-dimensional models of the lithology as well as the distribution of the contaminant. 115. Here's a very creative way to use this type of information as well. Dr. Steve Lieberman, who is one of the forefathers, if you will, of the triad approach, went to a site, got some laser-induced fluorescence information at several locations before remediation efforts were attempted. And so you see the red logs. And then after steam-enhanced extraction was applied, they went and pushed adjacent to those initial pushes, and you saw that there was a reduction in the amount of mass that was in the subsurface. So it's not quantifiable, but it was an interesting way to utilize this type of information. 116. Now, there's some great advantages to these types of probes. As I mentioned, you can detect multi-ring fuel compounds. It's great for non-aqueous phase liquids, primarily elm apples, but also a screening tool for Dean apples. You get a really rapid, real-time measurement, depth discrete. As I mentioned, you can couple this with other types of sensors. You could even design wells based on some of these other sensors that you use. It's a great screening tool, very high resolution, and there are many different vendors that you can go to now for different types of energy sources for fluorescence-based investigation. Another nice thing is that it's EPA certified, Cal EPA, and they entered into a memorandum of understanding many years ago with federal EPA. So there was reciprocity granted to most of the states. And there's ASTM standardization already available. As with most direct push technologies, it's limited by the type of soil that you're penetrating. You could have some false negatives and positives because there is a wavelength dependency. I can get into detail on that, or if you want to contact me, I can give you more details. Again, since it's fluorescence, it's not analyte specific. So say that you had benzene and naphthalene. Naphthalene is a phenomenal fluorophore, so if there's a little naphthalene, the signal will mask any type of resolution you can deconvolute out of that signal that would represent benzene. Therefore, semi-quantitative, so you still will require some confirmation samples. 117, please. GeoVis is a video microscope. It's a phenomenal tool. It's quite fascinating because it really gives you an insight to what actually exists. The conceptualizations that we've articulated in our art, if you will, of what we believe NAPL looks like in the subsurface has not really been very accurate. And it became very obvious when we started to look at some of the first images that came back from the GeoVis. Essentially, it's a CCD color video camera, and there's illumination of the soil as you're penetrating through the subsurface, and then you pass that signal to the surface. 118, please. This is one of my favorite images in our field. I've got some live video feed as well, or recordings of some video feed from the same push. But essentially what we're looking at is the box represents, since it's a microscope, a magnification up to 2.5 millimeters by 2 millimeters of the soil. And if you look at these darker zones, some of those are actually particles. But some of them, and if you see this in, when it's actually video streaming, it's fascinating because you can actually see these are globules. These are Nalpol globules. This is what it really looks like in the subsurface. I don't know of any other tool that can give you that kind of conceptualization of what actually exists. It's not always in pools, and the pores are not always interconnected. Another really beautiful aspect of this image is that you see that there's a vapor component right inside those globules. I've got some ideas for trying to determine what those vapors are comprised of, and I believe that that would be a nice way to articulate to regulators and clients that potentially bioremediation is occurring. So it opens up the door for many creative types of endeavors. 119, please. The advantages are, I believe it's a unique perspective regarding what really exists at our site. I may be wrong, and I welcome feedback on this after the call, but I believe it's the only true Nalpol confirmation tool. You can generate continuous graphic profile, and you can also get some hydrologic information. I'd use it for effective porosity distribution. Andrew Ward from the Department of Energy is using this for grain size distribution, so you can imagine where you can go with that. And then Len Sinfield has used this to evaluate Nalpol saturation. So that's nice if you want to determine the volume that might exist in subsurface before you start to remediate. The disadvantages are a few. The rate of data collection is really limited by your ability to process this information. For those of you who have been on the truck, you can probably attest to this. If you're watching this live, sometimes you actually feel a little bit seasick because of the way the frames move. In addition, the transparent Nalpol, since this is an optical approach, the Nalpol can be there, but it may be so transparent that you don't really recognize it as Nalpol. Again, as with all DP types of technologies, it can be limited by lithology. The porosity estimates, I mentioned I did some tests on this, are not great in silty sands. You get sort of a frappuccino image, and it's difficult to resolve using image processing that we've got. Again, it's semi-quantitative assessment. Let's go to 120. The membrane interface probe, I'm sure most people online are very familiar with. It's one of the workhorses now of the environmental field, and rightly so. It's a phenomenal screening tool with semi-quantitative capabilities. Essentially, there's a membrane and a heating element and a carrier gas so that you pass volatiles and semi-volatiles to the surface, and you can analyze those through a GC or some type of ion trap, mass spec, or other type of detector. And it's just a great tool for developing conceptual site models, chemical, for volatiles and semi-volatiles. You can also couple this with other types of tools to get an indication of the soil type. Let's go to 121. What we're showing here is depth on the x-axis. So we've got conductivity, which is essentially, they've got a little button on the side of their MIT probe to indicate what type of soil you're going through. And then you see the raw membrane interface probe results where the stream has been passed through an EC detector. And then at the bottom, you see for corresponding depths where you start to see some hits around 45 feet or so, you can actually trap a sample and then do further investigative efforts. So if you've got a GC and you have some time, or you have the manpower to be doing this simultaneously while you're sitting on another push, you can actually get a very nice quantitative or semi-quantitative at least depiction of the distribution of different types of analytes that might exist at your site. 122. Many advantages to the membrane interface probe. It's, as I mentioned, it's probably one of the best chemical screening tools you could utilize. You get a nice continuous profile, but you can also, as I mentioned, focus on specific depths. It's analyte specific because you can separate these through a GC. Many types of volatiles and semi-volatiles. And again, you can couple this with lithologic sensors for correlation, and you could probably also, I've seen it, coupled with some confirmation sampling devices. Unfortunately, when you're operating with a non-continuous configuration, the user needs to pre-select depths, to collect those more depth discrete samples. The constant operational conditions are not always possible. You get differences in the temperatures. So there have been some debates over whether or not it's a quantifiable approach. Again, the bulk fluids can't travel through the membrane, so you're not going to actually sweep NAPLs into the analytical tooling. It's semi-quantitative. You can have some clogging, and again, it's limited by lithology, and then you have a heat front issue that is also associated with many of these direct push technologies. 123. The cone sipper is a device that I believe ARA markets, and I've used it successfully many times. It's a great tool for confirmation. You can collect soil gas as well as fluid samples. There's a pneumatic valving associated with this, and you can actually collect samples up to 200 feet. There's an inert gas that passes through and replaces, through displacement, the sample. You can collect as many as two vials, conventional vials that you might send to a lab or run with a rapid test with a field mobile lab. You can decontaminate it downhole. And again, I believe that it's great for coupling with the membrane interface probe so that you get a great screening, and then you focus in on where you want to collect the confirmation sample. Use those, that kind of data in your model for flux. 124. You get depth discrete samples. Vapor and liquid can be collected. Very rapid. You can do rapid analyses if you've got a mobile lab. Again, it's an excellent confirmation tool for membrane interface probe as well as many of the fluorescence tools. There are some concerns about decontamination, and because of that, I recommend that when you use this, you focus on a step per push. It's not always coupled with sensors, but several creative folks in the environmental field are obviously doing so, and I think it's a great advantage. Clogging can occur. Again, you've got the lithology and the pressure front and heat front issues, as with other direct push tools. 125. The Waterloo Advanced Profiling System is sort of a variation on some of these themes. You can collect samples. You can see on the right in the picture that you're sampling multiple ports. You can couple this with field analyses and flow-through systems. You can measure head values. You get what they call an index of hydraulic conductivity. When you pass it through an inline flow-through cell, they're commonly now looking at other types of aquifer parameters above and beyond just the chemical concentration of the contaminant. And then you can grout through the tip, which is a nice advantage, particularly if you're dealing with D-NAPL zones and you have to penetrate finer zones. 126. Here's a slide that shows where the practitioners had a continuous profile of the hydraulic conductivity. Depth is in the Y direction here. And then for particular depths, they actually ran, they collected head, they let it equilibrate, they looked at conductance and pH and dissolved oxygen and redox potential through using the flow-through cell. So you can get quite a substantial amount of information with this type of tool. This is all for a single push. 127. The advantages include depth-discrete samples. You can look at vapor and liquid samples. You can rapidly analyze these materials that are coming to the surface. You can get some hydrologic information, including head and the relative K. And again, it's a great confirmation in site characterization, conceptual site modeling tool. It's limited by lithology, and one of the issues that I have is if you're going to generate models, you really need a quantified K value. So there are some limitations to how you might use that K information. 128. I'm going to switch gears a bit now, and I think that the APS was a good segue into the hydrologic tools, since they do cover head and K. The high-resolution PISA cone, I'm sure many of you have heard about this already, but essentially it's a sensor probe that has a pressure transducer that's customized, and we do corrections for barometric as well as temperature to get extremely high head resolution. So we can get head values down to about an inch or so of resolution to a little bit greater than 60 feet below the water table. This opens up a lot of opportunities. You can measure vertical gradients because of that. You can go to very small sites, like a gasoline station site, and have your pushes separated by as little as 25 to 50 feet and get a nice direction in 3D of the flow of the groundwater. You can simultaneously collect soil type as well as hydraulic conductivity, and you can quantify the hydraulic conductivity. There are many different ways to do that with the same single push data package. You can get hydraulic conductivity from the pressure dissipation because as you advance this into the subsurface, you're inducing pressure. So as that dissipates, that's sort of like a mini slug test. So the time that it takes to equilibrate is related to the permeability or hydraulic conductivity. You can also use soil type, and there are some lookup relationships. They're more order of magnitude in terms of resolution than the dissipation, but they are quite useful because you're getting soil type information approximately every centimeter or so. As with most DG technologies, there's minimal worker exposure. The system is currently on the Navy SCAP system down in San Diego, but it has been licensed to AMS, and it should be available within the next 2 to 3 months commercially. 129 shows what our data would look like for a single push. On the left log, I show soil type versus depth. Depth is on the y-axis. The second log shows the hydraulic conductivity based on that soil type, based on a lookup conversion. That third log is the dissipation-based hydraulic conductivity for particular depths where we stop the push and let it equilibrate. Okay, I'll get into a little bit more specifics in a second about that. The fourth log shows the effective porosity based on soil type. Okay, so we're essentially able to get the data that we need from this single push for the velocity calculations, the seepage velocity calculations we talked about earlier, and I'll come back to that in a second. Let's focus our attention on the lower right where it says dissipation test. What we're showing there are for 5 specific depths, we stop the push and let it equilibrate. And again, as I mentioned, the time that it takes for dissipation is related to the hydraulic conductivity. The final value is the pressure head, the pore pressure, at that particular depth. So, again, the dissipation test leads to hydraulic conductivity, and you see that in that third log. And then the chart above where it says final pressures, that's our hydrostatic pressure profile, looking at the final pressures versus depth. Now, if they fall on a line, then that's saying that you're in a hydraulically continuous unit. You're in the same water-bearing zone. If they fall off of that line, you can actually associate perhaps a textural observation like a clay with a truly confining layer. Also, you can take these specific head values and utilize those in models for three-dimensional flow because you can get gradients from that. And I'll get into that in a little bit more specifics in a bit. So 130, here's where we conducted some tests. ESTCP sponsored a group that I was working with to compare the high-resolution PISA code to more conventional approaches using wells, short-screen wells. So what I'm showing here are the head values from about a day and a half worth of pushing. So if you start with the upper right, you can see there's a two-dimensional surface superimposed on a block of these pushes, and that I'm rotating it. If you go counterclockwise, I'm rotating this to kind of show the type of fabric and detail that you're able to develop with these types of highly resolved head measurement tools. And there's a very shallow gradient, as you'll see in a bit. Within a 25-foot long zone, we got approximately 1 inch of total head differential, so it's very shallow. 131. Here's some images of preparation and implementation of the ESTCP project. So we initially went out in the field up in the upper left and ran some high-resolution PISA cone pushes to help us design wells. We installed those wells, as you can see in the middle, and then we installed our initial wells that were 3 foot long pre-packed screens. And then in the lower left, we actually installed wells clusters to three separate depths. And if you look at the very bottom middle, you can see a wellhead opened up, and each of those wells goes to different depths, and there's six inch pre-packed screens, and I show that sitting outside of the wellhead. And then on the upper right, we ran conventional tests for hydraulics, water level, as well as hydraulic conductivity. And then we actually ran the field demo adjacent to those wells. And we focused on a solid comparison between the data sets. 132. Here's where we're looking at head distribution. So in that previous illustration where I showed that three-dimensional with the two-dimensional superimposed of the head distribution, on the left, PISA cone, I peeled off that top layer. And then you can see the data that we get from wells, short screen wells, on the right. So while there are some subtle differences there in head distribution, the total range and the gradients are quite similar. In both data sets, we get approximately 1 inch range of total head in each of the clusters. So what that tells me is that in practice, if we're separating these pushes by 25 feet or so, we're going to get exceptional resolution both in 2D as well as 3D, on the direction and the gradient of flow. 133. One of the tricks to converting from taking head values, which are scalar, and generating a vector for gradient, which is essential for determining the seepage velocity according to Darcy's law, is that there needs to be some kind of conversion from the scalar value to the gradient. So if you go to 134, we show a very simple depiction of a finite difference relation for the x component of head. So what we essentially do is we generate a three-dimensional image of head distribution using interpolation. We discretize it, and at each grid cell, we run this calculation. But we do it for x, y, and z. So we convert the scalar head to a gradient in 3D. So if you go to 135, once we have that gradient at each one of those grid nodes, then we merge that with the distributions of hydraulic conductivity as well as effective porosity, and we calculate for velocity at each node. Now, if you have concentration data through NIP or cone zipper samples or other tools, even conventional well samples, you can generate a distribution of the three-dimensional elements associated with concentration, and then at each grid node, calculate the velocity times that co-located concentration, and you develop the contaminant flux distribution. Now, this is a very powerful concept. It needed not only the tooling, but we needed to modify the software. So GMS now has those capabilities. You can do this with obviously high-resolution piece of film, but you can also do this with more conventional approaches as well, conventional types of data. 136. So we ran some comparisons of some of the models that we generated at the site. On the left, we're showing well data, and on the right, we're showing one of the configurations of the PisaCone data for velocity calculations using GMS. Now, the mid-zone is about 10 to 10.5 feet in two dimensions in map view. The first row would be a source control plane, if you will. It's the first row of those nested wells or clustered wells. And the center line will go right through the main cluster network. Okay, so if you look at the top images, you know, you can see that they're approximately within the same range of velocity values. The first row as well, you don't see too much fabric that is, there is a little bit of similarity. Again, this is qualitative in nature. But then if you look at the center line, that path that the plume should take, you do see that the velocity distributions have some similarities there. Again, that's qualitative. We've got much more quantitative in this. But I don't want to get into too many details. I'll have a reference to the report if you're interested. 137. What we did was we simulated the release of a tracer. And then we ran this for several months into the future, and here's a snapshot at time 49. With that distribution of concentration, we merged that with the velocity distributions from the data set that I just showed you, the velocity data set, to determine the distribution of flux 49 days into it is what I'm showing here. And so you see that there are quite a few similarities. It's not perfect, but there are quite a few similarities. The well data set shows that there's a little bit of a different direction. It's going a little bit more towards the left of the diagram, whereas the PisaCone is going a little bit more towards the bottom of the diagram. But if you're a remediation engineer, you essentially have the same kinds of conclusions because these well clusters are 5 foot on center. So we're talking about really only about 15 by 15 area that you would be remediating. So you essentially would have the same results and conclusions about how to approach remediation. That first row depiction shows that source control plane, that it's going a little bit faster if you use the well data than the PisaCone data here. The center line looks almost identical as well, or not almost identical, but at least there are some great similarities here. So if you're a remediation engineer, you would essentially design the same type of approach, regardless of whether or not your data was comprised of well clusters or the PisaCone information. 138. I'm not going to get into all the details of all the iterations that we ran, but as you can see, we have many scenarios that we evaluated. 139, and here we're showing some of the results there where we looked at both concentration as well as flux, the predictions using well data versus the predictions using the PisaCone data. And so the top row shows the concentrations on the left here, day 14, then day 49, day 84. Those are the predictions using well data. And then we're showing the flux distributions predictions for the same time, 14, 49, and 84. That the well information would provide. K-mean, we'll just use that one. You can see that there are some differences, but it's extremely similar to what you got for the control data set, which is based on wells. 140. In terms of the performance, we met our criteria in terms of the accuracy for determining head values and flow rates and directions for hydraulic connectivity, for the modeling capabilities, and then for the time required to generate three-dimensional conceptual and transport models. 141. If you look at costs, for those of you who've seen some of my previous comparisons, I try to take an apples-to-apples approach, and it's obviously very difficult. Some of my earlier papers with the DNAPL approaches, I try to be very holistic, so I'm going to try to attempt to do the same thing here. So what I mean by apples to apples is, let's say that you come to a site and your goal is to generate a flux model. It could be a conceptual site model, or, as we're showing, it could be a more analytical model. Well, the innovative approach, if you will, would be use of high-resolution PZCone with membrane interface probe and a couple confirmation samples. And we want to get this model to be three-dimensional. So we would also model this. Versus a more traditional approach, or maybe an innovative traditional approach, if you will, where you have wells, aquifer tests, you collect samples, and we're talking about 10 map locations, but since we're going for 3D, it would imply that you would have 30 wells, or 10 clusters. Okay, so if you look at the cost comparison for doing these types of approaches, I've broken it down on the x-axis by depth. Okay, and then I also looked at several variations. So if you use 3/4-inch direct push wells or 2-inch direct push wells or drilled wells, those are the scenarios that I'm utilizing in this cost analysis versus the high-resolution PZCone MIP approach. So you can see with the 20-foot scenario that you've got quite a bit of margin there. So you're looking at over between $100,000 and $150,000 to generate that three-dimensional flux model using conventional approaches or even some innovative like direct push well approaches. It would be less than $50,000 for the high-resolution PZCone MIP approach for that same site. Now, I'm not including the costs for safety plans and things like that because I figure that those are going to be required regardless of what approach you opt for. So as you go deeper, the 50 and 75 foot examples, the differential becomes greater. So 142, if you look at cost savings, we were asked to evaluate what the near-term costs might be in terms of savings. And so as you can see, we're looking at early savings, and it's going to depend, obviously, on the depth of your site investigation. But we're looking at approximately $1.5 to almost $5 million in savings if we apply this at 20 sites, just for reference. Again, that's assuming that you can reach the 75-foot depth with the direct push technologies. 143, this is where it becomes very dramatic, the differences that you realize here. Time comparisons. So if you consider how long it would take to install the wells, run your analyses, do your aquifer tests, generate your models and your reports, several months are required, obviously. Even for the 20-foot scenario, using direct push wells, we're looking at approximately 3 months of work before you've got that model ready to hand to your remediation engineers. For the high-resolution PZCone, you're looking at about 2 weeks, and I was extremely conservative because we can actually generate a model before we leave the field in many cases. That's not a final report yet, but I think that the time advantages are quite obvious here. 144, several advantages I've already mentioned. It's very rapid, step the street. You get that hydraulic element, you can generate models, you get profiles of head and hydraulic conductivity, effective porosity, you can generate these three-dimensional distributions, both conceptual as well as analytical for velocity and flux, significantly lower costs, greater accuracy and usefulness of these transport models because of the resolution, and you can use this data to design wells because you've got soil type, and there's currently an ASTM standard on PZCone that's being updated for the high-resolution elements that have recently been demonstrated. Some of the disadvantages include that, as with most DP approaches, if you've got consolidated materials or gravels, it won't work. The other thing is that we're using geostatistics and interpolation. So if you've got some extreme conditions between the measurement locations, you might not be able to estimate those. You do not get a storage value in your hydraulic estimates, much like a slug test. You don't get storage. And then again, your hydraulic head measurements can resolve down to about 1 inch or greater, which is still phenomenal. And again, I have a link here to the report if anybody's interested in further information. 145. There's another very, very useful tool called the hydraulic profiling tool. GeoProbe markets this, manufacturers markets this. They actually inject water into the soil, and then they observe the changes, and you get a relative hydraulic conductivity, and you get static water levels in heads. If you've got the conductivity system, or maybe even conventional CPT types of probes attached, you can get soil type as well. The nice thing also is this can take a lot more abuse than the high-resolution PISA cup. Put it on a percussion rig or a hydraulic rig. Now, for the hydraulic profiling tool, or HPT, it's great because you get continuous profiling. It's useful for remediation design. Again, you can combine it with the soil type indicators, and it's a phenomenal conceptual modeling tool. One of the things that I'm hoping will be improved upon in the near future is that the hydraulic conductivity values are qualitative in nature. It's excellent if you're going to try to do some remediation design, but if you want to try to model and generate the types of flux models I've been talking about, you can't do that yet. There's some pretty heavy theory behind the K derivations. And if they can button up a few minor details, I think they're going to be able to get quantification. Hopefully that will happen soon. I know there are several very talented folks that are working on that. The electrical conductivity soil type device is not as resolved in silty sand to sand as well. So the conventional load cell approach of CPT has a little bit more resolution for those types of applications. I'm going to change gears now. I'm in 147. And now that we have these tools for generating a site model, both conceptual as well as analytical, now we want to start thinking about, we know we're going to have a problem, we know we're going to have to remediate, and we know that we're going to have to monitor. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some well design issues, and then some placement. We talked a little bit about that already. And then some installation opportunities. So 148. I know everybody's supposed to memorize this mantra out there. And I obviously can't see you, but if you're sitting in your chair, raise your hand if you utilize the ASTM D5092 to design your wells at every one of your sites. I can't hear you, but I know some of you are probably laughing right now because most people don't do that, unfortunately. But we all know that we're supposed to be designing our wells based on the qualities of the lithology in the zones that we want to screen. And so, in a nutshell, you get filter path grain size and gradation it is designed specifically to allow only the right kind of material to come through your filter path. If you go to 149, the formation grain size distribution dictates the filter path design and selection, and then that dictates your slot size selection. And I'm going to go to 150. So if you've done your grain size distributions, you consult this chart here from the standard and go to 151, please. The most commonly used combination is the 010-2040 combination. So it's an 010 slot size and a 2040 sand pack mesh. A lot of people go with the one size fits all. We know it's not good for silty sands or finer. We can pass silty sand through this material. I've seen it done. I've seen a lot of wells ruined because they might have used this kind of combination even in a clay. 152. Okay, since people aren't doing this, I'm assuming now, I'm not accusing anybody, but I'm just assuming that, Jeff Farr and myself, Jeff works at the Bureau of Rec, came up with an alternative that's based on cone penetrometer testing. So on 152, what we're showing is an LIF log on the left, then the soil type on the next log, okay, with depth vertical here. And then what we did was we came up with a relationship that would convert the soil type to the ASTM recommendations for sand pack as well as slot size. So if you look at your contaminant peaks here from LIF between about 8 feet and 10 feet, or let's just say 5 feet and 10 feet, and then you go to that third log here, and you see that you are straddling both the 2040 or the 100 sand pack, you might want to select the 100 sand pack if you were going to screen that zone, and then the associated 005 slot size. Similarly, if you were going to look at the next peak from about 14 feet and down, and then you go to the corresponding sand pack and slot size depths, you would see that the 2040 and 010 might work just fine, because you're talking about a sand and a silty sand. Okay, 153. Here's an example where for the high-resolution Pisa cone site, we selected a zone between about 10 and 13 feet because we were in a bit of a silty sand, and we had 2040 and 010 for that specific location. 154, please. Okay, now we're going to start to bring this whole, bag of tricks together into a conceptual framework for optimizing your approach and streamlining your approach. So let's think about this in terms of, if you step back a bit, let's say that you know you have a problem and you're going to want to get the right kind of information for evaluating remediation design. And then you want to, once you have that design, you want to have a network in place to evaluate how effective that remediation is proceeding. So, initially, you would generate a model, the seepage velocity and concentration distributions, so you can use conventional approaches like welds and samples and hydraulic tests, or you can use one of the tools that we just talked about, like high-resolution PisaCone, membrane interface probes, and cone zipper confirmation. You can use the FARA-CRAM method for designing the monitoring wells, and you can install those wells. And then you've got your initial model generated, and then if you think about what in those models are constant and what in the models are dynamic, you notice that the only dynamic elements are head to get gradient, and concentration. So if you are monitoring those two parameters, concentration and water level or head, then you can update the flux distributions, both in three dimensions as well as in transects. So that would be your remediation performance evaluation tool. You can use the source control plane as a transect, or you can do this in three dimensions. And you can use this to evaluate your plume status. Is the plume stable? Is it contracting? Is it growing? And you can use this as a remediation metric. How much flux did you reduce this by? Now, I'd like to really plant a few seeds, because I believe that you might be able to use this as a line of evidence and perhaps even convince regulators that this is a valid metric for demonstrating that your remediation is, in fact, working. So 155. With that, I'd like to hand the baton off to Greg, because he's going to talk about many applications that relate to capturing some of these dynamic parameters using automation and sensor-based as well as telemetry types of technologies. I'm not sure if Mike wants folks to take a break or not, but I'm certainly going to be quiet for a bit myself.
Hey, Mark, let's. This is Mike. Why don't we answer a few questions here, And then we'll take a then we'll take a 5-minute break if that works for you guys.
Excellent. Or,
okay. Is there anybody on the phone that has any questions for Mark?
Mark, with a high piezo cone, I mean with the piezo cone technology, what is the well size you can put in with those? If you back, you know, pull them out and then leave a well behind?
You know, it's a good question. We don't actually install wells with the high-resolution piezo cone. Right now, the diameter of the cone itself is 1.44, but AMS is also working on a 1.75 diameter system. Now, it is possible to retract the sensor probe and then go back in there and install a well right in the same location if you're lined up appropriately. That is a possibility. We haven't done that. Typically what we do is we'll grout the hole, and if we want to install a well, we'll do it adjacent to that. But you can, with direct push technologies, I've seen wells up to 3.5 inches in diameter.
Thanks, Mark.
Hey, Mark, we have a couple questions about the LIF that you were talking about earlier that came in through, from online. And the first question is, have you been successful in using LIF data to estimate LNAPL mass and volume? In the STEAM example, did they use the LIF or confirmation sample data to estimate the mass reduction?
That's a great question. I have not used LIF for mass and volume. We actually, with one exception, we were asked to come out to a site where there was a release of diluent, several million gallons of diluent, along the coast in California, on a Department of Defense site. But since we had this unique capability at the time, we were invited to come out there and help them determine the volume. Now, in order to do that, if you consider that this material was lighter than water and that very little of it would get below the capillary fringe, what we were assuming is that our LIF signal represented the thickness of that product. It's not always perfect, especially if you've got water table moving up and down and smearing, but it was a rough estimate of what we felt the thickness of the product would be. We made some estimates based on soil type of the porosity. And then we made some estimates of, you know, how much air there might be in those pores within that zone. And so we did come up with some volumetric estimates based on LIF. We evaluated several lobes of the release and came up with several million gallons, actually. And they're still using some of the data that we derived from that. In terms of the sampling, what was the second part of the question? Mike? Hello?
Hey, yeah, Mark. The second, the second question? We had, how efficient is using the fluorescent probes for delineation of free product? And what are the calibration requirements for the fluorescence probe?
That's another great question. Now, product means different things to different people. In a well, when you have product going into that well, you know that it's moving, right? So there's some gradient. I don't know if I want to go so far as saying that all the fluorescent signals that we see are free moving product, but it's definitely product that is there. In order to determine whether or not it's moving, you would have to do some, maybe even some pore pressure measurements. But we definitely can see free product. I'm not sure if we can say it is free product, but we can definitely say that there's product there, and we know how thick that insult zone is. The nice thing about the window, it's a sapphire window, is that it's actually self-cleaning. So once you reach the bottom of your signal, you see that it attenuates. So that tells us that we're beyond the base of where that the contact is between the water and the product itself. In terms of calibration, we use an internal standard where we use a known fluorophore, and we use that at the very beginning and at the end of each push. So when we bring it up to the hole, up hole, we'll actually fire our laser signal through the window into that standard to help calibrate. Now, there's some other things that we notice as well that help you determine whether or not it's a product. Because naturally occurring organics like humic and fulvic acids will also fluoresce, and you're obviously going to see some of that in the subsurface, especially if you're near a wetland or somewhere where there's some shallow organic materials, maybe roots, etc. And the fluorescent signal, we're not just tracking the intensity. We're looking at something we call the peak wavelength. So we're scanning a frequency range, and in that signal that comes back to the surface, a petroleum constituent will give you a different type of peak wavelength than a naturally occurring organic. And in fact, some of the folks from Dakota are getting even more resolved than that, where they're picking specific target wavelengths in that signal, and they're able to determine what type of fuel it is, and if there's a controversy over who's at fault, they could sometimes distinguish between different products from different sources.
Okay, Mark, we've got another question here that came in online. What tools would you recommend for investigating an old wood treatment facility contaminated with creosote and fuel oils?
That's a great question. If there's an ample amount to get to the point where it gets more dense than water, you're going to have some challenges. But laser-induced fluorescence would work very well, I believe, if you can access some of the products, you can fairly easily sample to one of the service providers and see if they can detect the material. So I would do that first before you deploy. Make sure that you can definitely get some hits on that. But it would be, a multi-pronged approach would be LIF, membrane interface probe, high-resolution piezocone. Develop the concentration distributions as well as the hydraulic distribution, and then generate your models from there. But again, make sure that you can detect the material. And if there are materials that are going to go deeper, that's going to obviously be a challenge. So the MIT will, you might be able to see, if you can get right into the source with the laser systems, you might be able to see something, or with the optical systems. There are also some optical systems based on LAMPS. You may be able to actually see the source, but the MIT should be able to pick up at least the solute portions of that. So it would have to be a multi-pronged approach, and then obviously with some confirmation samples.
Are there any other questions from the phone lines for Mark?
Yeah, this is Joe Robb from AMEC. I just have a question for Mark with respect to using mass flux. I think that you used the phrase paradigm shift, and that certainly got my curiosity with respect to how that might be going. A lot of effort has been put into coming up with human health and ecological standards that are concentration-based comparisons, and you're taking a different look and looking at mass flux. I guess my question is, have you had any initial feedback from regulators with respect to using a mass flux-based approach to looking at site remediation?
That's a great question, and I'm very glad that you asked that. There are several areas that look extremely promising. The first one is, if you've been looking at some of the workshop material that's been published coming out of CERDIP and ESTCP, they've been collaborating with some of the leading practitioners and regulatory groups to identify where the gaps need to be filled in our field. And contaminant flux, in particular with respect to DNAPLs, has been identified for the last few years as an area where they need to fill that gap. And in fact, they've funded several investigations. Dr. Johnson from Arizona actually used Flux to compare many different remediation approaches. And then also ESTCT funded the passive Flux meter that you've probably read about, and they won an award, I believe, last year for the best ESTCT project. Part of that was to also encourage regulatory groups to start approving of these as metrics, if you will. As a result of the promising efforts, ITRC has recently started a new document that focuses specifically on the use of Flux for many applications, but in particular, and I'm going to be helping them with this, I'm going to try to focus on using this as a remediation performance metric. Now, Suresh Rao from Purdue and Mike Hatfield from Florida, they've actually been doing some pretty interesting things to try to determine, you know, the relationship between Flux and concentration and maybe interpret that Flux, that loading, to an anticipated concentration distribution, which would then be amenable to the conventional approaches for evaluating risk. So I think that this multi-pronged set of activities is going to very shortly, very soon, I'm hoping within the next 6 to 18 months, lead to regulatory acceptance on if you know me, you know I'm very optimistic, so hopefully I'm not too far off, but I believe that we're all in concurrence now and that the industry, in particular the regulatory component of the industry, is going to be in line with that as well.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks, Mark. Now, this is Mike. Just so that you guys have enough time to finish, I think we'll stop with the questions here, and we'll take a 5-minute break. If we'll resume at 1:20 Eastern time, and if you guys have any questions, you can send your questions in through the text during the break, and we'll try to answer them later on in the presentation.
Okay, we'll be back in 5.
Great, thanks. Okay, welcome back everybody from the break. Next up in our presentation is Greg Gustafson. And take it away, Greg.
Hello, folks. I'm Greg Gustafson with Instrumentation Northwest. I've been designing and developing and marketing environmental tools and sampling and sensor equipment since about 1982. And what I'm going to talk about today is the convergence of technologies towards the ability to bring data to your desktop. And I kind of wanted to go back to Mark's last slide to focus on two things, level and concentration, as the variables after you've characterized the site to really bring home the point that with just those two parameters, you can install sensor systems and bring data to multiple sites to your desktop that would actually allow you to update the performance remediation of your site. Slide 2.2. What comprises a long-term monitoring system are sensors, some kind of wireless telemetry-enabled capability, and software if you want real-time monitoring capabilities. Slide 2.3. Basically, the technology has converged now to the point where a number of vendors have developed sensors that can be deployed in the field for long-term applications. And the debate is going on is whether or not some of these sensors can actually replace sampling technologies. The advantages, if you go to slide 2.4, is really outlined in terms of the two different methodologies and some of the potential innovations that real-time sensing can do. The typical sampling, long-term sampling methodologies is you go to the site and you collect samples, and in a lot of cases sound for level or take water level indicators to do that. You gather all of that data, you analyze it, you come back and generate a report for your client. If you go to real-time sensors, you can bring that data to your desktop, and there's a lot of potential advantages of doing that, including potentially some cost savings. Slide 2.5. One of the big benefits of real-time monitoring is that you can get a lot more data a lot more frequently, and it will allow you to do early detection of change in the case of remediation, in the case of potentially polluting facilities such as landfills or major industrial sites or tanks. You can do early alarming and early detection of these if you put low-cost detective sensors in place. The advantage of doing that, of course, from a practical point of view, is that early detection means less cleanup cost and potentially a safer environment for all of us. Slide 2.6. The other thing that real-time sensing will do is it gives you a lot more data a lot more frequently so that you can look at a lot of the temporal variations in contaminant levels or just levels in general, whether it's temperature or level or concentration variables, versus a traditional method where you may not see data for 3 months, 6 months, or even a year on a lot of these sites. And so you can see some of the fluctuations and some of the changes coming about and hopefully have a lot more useful information to make better decisions from. One of the things that really Mark is alluding to in his technology and the technology that's been developed for characterizing sites is that with very low-cost sensor technology, you can monitor remediation performance. The reason you can do that is you can automatically track some of the dynamic parameters, in particular level and concentration. With the sensor technology and a lot of the lower-cost wireless technologies coming into this environmental market now, you can also route that data, whether through cell or wireless connections, to your models and to your desktop for more rapid decision making. Slide 2.8. So, I guess in respect to that, I mean, I'm kind of repeating this point, but, you know, with more data coming from more locations, the other benefit that you can get out of sensor technologies is you can actually have resources monitoring multiple sites from one location, so that you can actually do a better job of allocating needed resources to go out and look at issues that might come up from a more frequent data collection routine. So some of the real major technical benefits is again, you can look at multiple sites at the same time or flip from one site to another when you're connected through the internet to a variety of sites. And because sensors don't require a person on site, you can put sensors in locations that you might not be able to get to very easily if they're hazardous locations, and you can put more sensors in to a wider ranging area to give you benefit of more temporal data. And it also reduces the amount of cost that you might have on site with people driving to sites to collect data, mobilizing and doing some of those kinds of things, which would reduce your carbon footprint. So the economic benefits from that, again, is it reduces sites, reduces your sites to your trips to sites. And a real key point I think that's important is, again, is if your sites for the most part are non-hit, you're still going out to these sites and gathering all of that information really to basically say the same thing that you already know. But if you do have a hit and sensors can identify that, it allows you the ability to better allocate resources and which would hopefully reduce costs and provide more responsive environmental cleanup efforts. So at the end of that, the end of the argument for sensor technologies, the hope is that you'll have better information and make better decisions. So what are some of the sensors that are commercialized today that can allow you to, that you can put in place that you can trust for long-term monitoring? So I'm going to talk a little bit about the three aspects of this. So what are the useful parameters? You know, what is a quality of measurement? And what sensors have been ruggedized for the environmental field? And then I'm going to talk a little bit about wireless connectivity. And then I'm going to turn this discussion back to Mark to talk a little bit more about some of the real-time software contouring capabilities of his company, Groundswell. Slide 212. So the first component of a monitoring system is slide 214. It's sensors. And so when you choose a sensor and you're out trying to figure out what sensors to choose that you can deploy for long-term monitoring, you really do want to look at the specifications of the product. You want to look at its accuracy and bias. You want to look at the capabilities or the long-term drift characteristic of the sensors. you want to make sure that you choose a sensor in the range of interest, and that it has been calibrated with traceable standards. In some cases, you want to look very clearly at the resolution of the device, and I could go into each one of these things if people really want to know a little bit more about the differences between a traceable standard and the resolution, accuracy, and bias of a sensor. I'm not going to have a lot of time today to go over all of those points. The other thing you want to look at in the smart sensors of today is how much memory can they collect. One of the reasons you might want to look at that is if a sensor can collect more data, you may not have to hook up to it as often. If you wanted to upload data quarterly, for example, you can still get all of that data every day from a sensor, but it may not be giving you alarm capabilities if you do it that way. Nevertheless, data storage is a feature that sensors have today in terms of how many data points they can collect. And a big issue is power consumption, especially on remote sites where you either got a solar power, a sensor technology, or have line power or running off of batteries. Some of the other specifications that you want to look at in a sensor is the temperature sensitivity error that you're going to get from various devices. You want to make sure that your devices are temperature compensated. And at a lot of these sites, industrial sites and others, you're going to end up having a lot of electrical noise and radio interference noise, that kind of electronic noise that you want to make sure the sensor's been designed to be immune to, and that it's designed for the ruggedness of your environment and the chemicals that you might have in your various wells. Again, looking at the materials, the construction of the device, and the pressure rating of the device, if you're going to deploy it in deep wells, all of those things are important to understand when you read a specification. 215. So what are some of the parameters that are out there today that have been proven in the field for long-term monitoring applications? The most common sensors out there are pressure, which gets translated to level or hydraulics. Temperature sensors are used now more than ever, and some of the global warming issues are out there. Folks are looking at temperature over long-term periods of time. You have your millivolt devices for like pH, oxidation, reduction potential, and some specific ions now, which there are sensors you can deploy for long-term monitoring for chloride, bromide, and nitrate. You have your conductivity type sensors and your dissolved oxygen technology, some of which have gotten to be very good with some of the luminescence and lens-based type dissolved oxygen sensors. And turbidity, and I think Mark can talk quite a bit more about TCE, but some of the companies like Scott Burge, the Burge system for measuring TCE and field analytes. Additionally, there's a number of folks out there, and I think when you look at innovative technology, there's a lot of concern, and because of the concern, folks are out there trying to develop a variety of radiological and chlorinated hydrocarbon biological type sensors. Some of these are in development and some of them I think are worth looking at as, they progress out of the laboratory into the field. And they're becoming more and more refined. The cost of building these and because of the miniaturization of technology, I think there's a lot of promise for a lot of new parameters to come into the field. So I think it's timely for folks to understand that sensors are beginning to have capabilities to replace sampling methodologies for monitoring and environmental monitoring applications. Your typical installation of sensors, I'm going to talk a little bit about that to give folks a general understanding. I think I mentioned earlier a little bit why I asked Mark about what are the capabilities of some of these methodologies for push point to lead back wells to minimize cost. You know, obviously every well you put in, there's an added cost to that. So as you get into the installation of sensor technologies, it's important to understand if you can combine installation with some of the push point technologies, I think there's some future cost benefit. Nevertheless, I think when you look at a lot of the new innovative wells, constructions and things that can be put into the ground, you want to look at the diameter of the well. It's probably one of the key considerations for sensor technology. Slide 218. from my knowledge, you know, I guess one of the points that I would like to put out there is typically you're looking at 2-4 inch being a very common size for at least at one time. Now going into your 2-inch standard monitoring well, there's a lot of sensor technology that can be put in 2-inch wells. When you go down one more size, there's a big difference between a 1-inch well and a 3/4 inch well. There's a fair amount of technology out there where the sensor diameters are 3/4 of an inch or about 0.75 inches in diameter. And at that diameter, it's very difficult to put sensor technologies into a 3/4 inch well because they're either not straight or because of the schedule of the pipe, some of it's schedule 80, some of it's schedule 40. So 3/4 inch diameter sensor technology really needs a 1-inch well. So if you're looking at well sizes, the cost difference between a 3/4 and a 1-inch well really isn't all that much, be sure and select a 1-inch well if you can. It gives you a lot more options of sensor technologies. But anyway, you're looking here at a typical installation. You've got some kind of protective monument initially on sensor installation. This particular sensor installation does not have wireless stuff enabled. If you're going to put sensors out in the field and then come out with personnel to collect data, this is what you typically see, whether it's above grade or below grade. And I think if you go to slide 219, you'll see sort of a typical below grade installation. With the sensor technologies of today, personnel can go out to a service port on a sensor or a connector that you might have, and you can upload data with personnel for collecting, let's say, data points once a day or every 15 minutes for 3 months, come out and service that. Again, looking at the sensors that actually have power inside, they're self-powered sensors, and they collect data on their own. So in these installations, the biggest issue on all of them is to protect that service port from flooding or from water or from condensation damage. So you'll see that there's a lot of desiccant type discussions in some of the sensor manufacturers to protect these service ports or the cabling from getting moisture and the consequent entrainment or coming on down the cable and getting into sensors and damaging them. When you're leaving stuff out for long periods of time unattended, it's a real important thing and a real important consideration. Folks address level sensing a couple of different ways, and in some cases they want vented sensors for barometric compensation. In some cases folks put 2 sensors in where they've gone to an absolute sensor for measuring hydraulic pressure and a barometric sensor for compensating the total pressure. But whether you do it with a port like this or not, either way you're still going to have a connector in that you're going to come out and service or connect into. It's very important that that gets well protected from moisture entrainment. That's probably the number one issue in our servicing capabilities is poor maintenance of that. You also can have multiple completions, and again, from a technical point of view, it's important to understand whether or not your sensors can be easily multiplexed into one particular service port. This is important later on when you're going to potentially put wireless telemetry to a one single location as opposed to having multiple wireless connections. Most sensors today can be networked fairly easily, but that's not the case always. Slide 221. When you convert, or if you want to upgrade a system, or you're looking at sensor technology, it's really important to understand that not all sensor technology is easy to interface into telemetry systems. Probably the key technical feature on sensor development for something that would enable it to hook to a telemetry system that you want to understand is whether or not the system uses a standard acceptable radio protocol. Slide 222. What that means is that when you're looking at radio communications or modem communication, you need packeted data, and there's a number of protocols that packet data. But basically what happens is you send a small packet of data, it gets confirmed that that packet was received or sent in the protocol. So that ensures the reliability of the data transfer over the air, whether it's going through a license-free or a licensed radio or through a cellular network. basically, when you begin to look at radio technology or telemetry, you're looking at a variety of radios, whether it's a Bluetooth or a Wi-Fi. All of those are radio devices. The question that you want to ask yourself is, what is the range of the radio, and what is the amount of energy that is required to run that radio? When you look at Wi-Fi technology or Bluetooth technology, which is right now the shortest range technology, you don't get much more than 20 feet on some of that stuff. When you go to Wi-Fi, you might get 100 feet, and if you look at some of the long-haul stuff, you might get 100 yards. But there's also low-cost radios out there that are license-free in the 900 megahertz spectrum that can go on a 1-watt license-free radio up to 5 miles. And if the radio technology has store and forward repeating, you can hop 5 miles to 5 miles to get a host radio at a central location that is hooked into a cell modem or something, or to a computer that would allow you to make connection to a remediation site network. A lot of these remediation sites are not very far, so the more wattage the radio has, one, the more power it requires, and the more range you can go, but you also reduce costs if you've got 100-watt radios. A lot of the new technology today is very low power and very sensitive, so it's, and low cost. Slide 23. But this is a typical installation if you were going to be looking at, let's say, a remediation site. You'd have sensors going to radio modems, potentially with solar panels or battery-operated stuff, antennas coming back to a central location. Again, the range on some of this stuff can be as far as 5 miles, or that field office, if we go to slide 24, again, you can go multiple repeaters to get back to a central location, but I think you also will find that you have the ability with all of this stuff to replace the PC. If you go to slide 226, I believe, you're going to have a modem. And it's really nice if your technology is able to go from, let's say, license-free radio points where you might have 10 wells, you bring that all back to one location where you have one cell modem with a network of sensors. With that kind of methodology, you reduce the cost of your cell time, because any time you have a cell modem, you're on a monthly subscription service through your telephone company. Slide 227. These are just typical installations that you can do with most radio sensor and smart sensor technology today. Again, the beauty of having an IP cellular modem is you're basically connected to a site through an IP address. That allows anybody that has that IP address, depending on how you implement it, and again, you can go as secure as you want on this technology, just like a bank or anything else can do, but you do have access to multiple sites through IP modem addressing today. 228. So you can have very complex networks implemented from a very small start where you just got a sensor, a recording sensor on site, and then you can begin to add remote to repeater to host radios that can be connected to IP cellular modems. And again, you can go to multiple IP modems through software products. Slide 229. All you really need to do if you have sensors already installed on your well is to go out and strap radio modems that are protected from the weather to your wellhead. The antenna is the key component of your radio technology. Again, you might see in this picture we have it pointed down. That actually attenuates the signal a little bit. Radio technology really is dependent on the height of the antenna. But we like to put antennas on the downside of our box to protect any leakage into the boxes and to protect the antenna on the downside. It's really a moisture-dependent issue. But you don't have to do it that way. You really just need to make sure you don't get moisture into your electronics, of course. Slide 230. Again, if you do have issues and you've got the ability to put radios on poles, the higher they go up, the better reception you're going to get. Height is a key feature of radio reception, and antenna selection is a key selection. Again, those are technical details that you can talk to a number of vendors about. The key issue, though, is that height is the key thing to be aware of on radio technology. Again, if you do have repeater know-how, if you go to slide 231, I think what you'll see here is that you can put these things inside of boxes and go to a repeater nearby on a pole or a trailer that's separated, and then you get your range. Again, you can get your height by putting a radio up high and transmitting from a flush mount monument like you see in slide 232, I believe. So that can then go from that to a line of sight radio that might be higher mounted on a pole someplace. That will then get that off the ground where you have low reception to where you have high reception. Slide 33. Hang on here. So again, that's just the point that I wanted to make is that is how you can overcome flush mount situations where you have something in the middle of a road or at a gas station or someplace like that, and you're trying to avoid wiring costs. You can transmit short distances from the ground to a higher elevation that would then allow you to get out to your 5-mile range or to a cellular modem that might be attached to that link. Again, you're going to lose radio reception, so there's been a number of developments, and Mark has actually worked with some folks in terms of building fiberglass monuments. Steel attenuates radio signals, so it is important to realize that, and we recommend that you use a fiberglass cover for these flush mount monuments. Slide 234. This is a typical installation, actually, that we did about 10 years ago, but it kind of really highlights the principles of a typical real-time monitoring system. You'll see the well there on your right, and you'll see a big box with a big battery at the time. Now, that big box is basically down to the size of about a basic lighting junction box, 2x3 or 2x4 inches, and very small one, and in some cases, 1-watt solar panels where you got half amp hour lead acid batteries sitting on these things about the size of your fist. So you got the ability again now to put stuff in very small compact areas, and the cost from a system like this, which 10 years ago might have been $10,000, to the point where some of these systems are now out in the market for about $500. Slide 35. So what are some of the software features that you need to be aware of if you're going to go to a telemetry-based real-time system? I'm going to talk a little bit about the basic administrative capabilities of your software that are sort of the minimum things that you really should have in any kind of software product that you look at in terms of a host tool or some kind of an operating system. If you go to slide 36, the first thing to consider is you're going to want your software to be able to look at the status of your system. If you have multiple wells, multiple locations, you want to be able to look, one, at your radio capabilities, you want to look at your remote wells, and you want to look at the sensors that are in those wells. Slide 37. Most of the software was going to be able to display the data in real time, and hopefully that's easy to do, and you can click on your sensor and see the information that you want in real time, and that the sensors are also collecting data in a time series method. Slide 238. Again, most of the software out there does make it fairly easy to set up data collection routines that you might need for collecting data, whether it's level or concentration, to feed into a software product like Mark's. Slide 39. And a lot of the software will have very simple time series graphing capabilities. It makes it easy if you're going to go out And again, I think the state of the art today is most folks go out to these recording sensors and they upload data to their computer. It's real nice to know that that software has the ability to give you a quick view of the last data collection or from the last period of time you went out and actually uploaded data. When you go to real-time systems, this data actually gets ported automatically into modeling software that has tremendous capabilities, whether it's alarming you by text messaging and some of those kind of capabilities. All of that is out there today, and it is very sophisticated stuff. The cost of the software has come down to a certain degree, but I think when you look at some of the sophisticated modeling web-based systems, some of that there is a fair amount of cost too. Slide 240. Again, you want to see if your software will allow you to export data to other programs. Again, with the kind of software that we provide, that actually is included with the cost of the sensors. So you get a lot of this stuff for free, but then, you know, what do you do with this information? That is the key point that, you know, if you go away from this meeting with any kind of knowledge, that yes, you can put lots of data into these programs, but you do need an intelligent program and an intelligent operator at the end of the day to make good decisions. But you now have the ability to put one heck of a lot more information into these models. And so if we go to slide 41, you're going to see some stuff that Mark is going to talk to you about that actually allows you in real time to look at broad areas, to look at these things in real time and to do some of the remediation monitoring that heretofore you really may have cost you a lot of money and time to do, but that you can get some very, very sophisticated information updated all the time. And again, I think Mark probably will say the same thing. Once you've characterized the site with the tools that he talked about at the beginning of this presentation, those things don't change unless there's a major geological event. So with very simple data coming into these programs, you can now get real-time performance updating, and that stuff is available today. So I want to thank everybody for listening to what I had to say, a little bit about sensors, the software connection tools that makes it easy to bring this data back to your desktop, and a little bit about some of the software that you can go. I'm more than happy to answer questions at the end of this discussion. I think Mark has some things that he wants to talk about in respect to the software modeling tools that are out there today. But with the capabilities and some of the innovative sensors that are coming into this market today, you have the ability to have a lot more information and as a result have better project and better decision making. Thank you. Thank you very much. Are there questions, Mike, that you want me to take now, or should we go through Mark's presentation?
Well, why don't we take one or two right now? I've got one that came in online that I'll read to you here, and then we'll check with the people on the phone.
Okay.
The first question is, the upper part of the casing is typically not representative of the water in the aquifer because it is stagnant. Usually we purge the wells before sampling to get a representative sample. How do the sensors in the well overcome this and give us a representative sample of the aquifer?
Well, there's sort of a short answer to that. I think what the science has been saying, and it's one of the reasons that low flow and no flow sampling is becoming more and more accepted. If the wells are properly constructed, I think at the end of the day, what has been proven is that if there's hydraulic flow through the screen zone, you have a representative sample in and around your sampling device. So in some wells, if you do put your sensor in a stagnant zone, and it's stagnant in that sense, you're not going to get representative sensing. When it comes to hydraulic gradient, particular level, which is a major component of certainly what Mark needs for his modeling, is that that's connected to the aquifer, and you get hydraulic change from a properly constructed well. So I think what I guess my short answer is, it has a lot to do with proper well construction. If your well is such that it does need purging and you're looking at concentration sensors, you are absolutely correct. That would not be suitable because you'd have to gather a sample. But I also, you know, again, if you're going to look at hydraulics and you need a lot of level measurement, and you don't have a concentration sensor available, you would have to gather a sample and have it analyzed, and then you could manually input that data into Mark's model subsequent to that to get flux modeling. So it's, again, a number of ways to skin that cat, but that's sort of the exciting part from the research that's been done for micropurging and for low-flow sampling and for no-flow sampling is that in order for that to actually work, folks have proven now that you don't need to purge the well in order to get representation.
Okay. Is there anybody on the phone lines that has a question for Greg? Okay, I guess we'll move back over to Mark's portion here. Thanks, Greg.
Yep. Thank you. Thank you very much, Greg, and thanks, Mike. I'm on slide 3.1 right now, and before I dive in again, real quickly, I want to just mention that what Greg mentioned a second ago is, I think, the main point here regarding whether or not you can believe some of these sensor readings with respect to the purge concern. Passive samples, diffusion samples, and some of the other technologies like the SNAP sample, ESTCP and other groups have clearly demonstrated that they do provide you with valid information. Since that's the case, it seems equally applicable to the types of analytical tools that Greg was just talking about. Now, speaking of analytical tools, I'm displaying on slide 3.1 a system that was developed by Scott Burge from Burge Environmental. And I won't go into too many details, but he's got essentially a system that the EPA has approved as a method, but he's ruggedized this method so that it's autonomous and operational in the field. You do have to go out there and change some of the reagents from time to time, but it's an optical system, but it does pull a sample from the subsurface into a reaction cell. It actually adds an amendment to it, and then there's a photoreaction that is related to the concentration. And he does do some purging as well in the well, so he's tracking pH and temperature and conductivity for stability before he routes the sample into the analytical chamber. But he's able to analyze for TCE, hexavalent chromium, some explosives, carbon tetrachloride as well, and now strontium-90, and I understand that he's going to be demonstrating another system for technetium very soon. Slide 3.2 shows where Scott has deployed the system at the Hanford Nuclear Facility adjacent to the Columbia River. And in that image, due to some of the climatic constraints and insulation requirements, you'll see that he's actually set the reaction chamber below ground, below surface. And then he has sort of a construction box that controls the sampling module and stores some of the power supply, etc. And he's using a solar cell, and he does have telecommunication capabilities there. So we've essentially networked his system so that we can be the recipients of that data. He's also coupled this with water level, which is really exceptional, because then we get all the things we need to develop our flux models. 3.3. So getting back to the concept where you generate your initial model, and use the tools, some that we described earlier, you generate your initial model, and from that you deploy a monitoring well network. And then again, since hydraulic conductivity and effective porosity are probably not going to change much, yes, you can have an earthquake, and that would be an exception, but really the water levels and the concentration are going to be the dynamic constituents that we're going to be monitoring for. So you can track those flux distributions both in three-dimension as well as specific transects, and then we can use that to evaluate remediation effectiveness. So what we do is we route that data directly into our models and update the new values that came from the sensors to track the changes. 3-4. Again, just conceptually, so you'd want to deploy your sensor network and your well network to be amenable to meet the specific objectives, namely determining whether or not remediation is working or whether or not the plume is stabilizing. 3-5 shows that, again, you can, with approximately 10 to 15 or 20 locations, you can surround your plume and come up with some appropriate information that's very similar to the type of information that you would be providing manually or conventionally. But here we're going to route this in a more expedited approach, a la triad. So in 3-6, just to quickly review, again, that seepage velocity equation, you can get your hydraulic conductivity and your gradient from the Pisa cone. Again, the gradient is a dynamic component. You can get your effective porosity from the Pisa cone and from the soil type. And then with flux, you can get your concentration of your solute from the membrane interface probe initially, some cone sipper, some of the other devices we talked about, and then replace that with the sensors themselves to, for instance, for birds, get TCE concentration distributions. So 3-7, I think I've already discussed this, so let's go into 3-8. Here's a conceptualization we've been developing, and we're very close to having this ready. We can already do automated contouring of any of the data that Greg and others can monitor for. And what we're doing now is we're routing this through a model to update that model as we've been discussing. And so what I'm showing here are 6 panels where you've got volumetric distribution of TCE, a center line, which goes right through that plume, and then the row 1, which would be the source control plane, just down gradient from where that source is. And then if you look on these time series analyses, these histograms, what we've done is we've come up with an idea that regulatory community is embracing. It's a new metric for remediation performance, if you will. So what we do is we could take the information, we could take, for instance, the flux value that exists throughout the domain. Let's say we'll take the volumetric time series. We can integrate all the values and come up with a single value. So we come up with a cumulative value for flux at that time step. We can do the same for the centerline transect as well as for the row 1 source control plane transect. Now, in and of itself, this may not make a lot of sense, but in the context of time series, it makes a tremendous amount of sense. So if you go to 3-9, you see that the plume is moved and you're tracking the flux. You're probably at the peak zone for the center line in row 1 as well as the volumetric, that individual flux value. Maintaining the grid as well as all our algorithmic tendencies and configurations for consistency. And then 3-10 shows that we're starting to see that there's a drop in that cumulative flux, both in 3D as well as in the transects. So what I would tell a regulator, if I was observing this at my site, is that a remediation upgrading is working, or that natural attenuation is actually occurring, because the total load to the aquifer, the total flux, the movement of that slug is decreasing. I've seen some beautiful illustrations in the site characterization phase by Suresh Rao and others, where they looked at transects and cumulative flux through transects that were separated by quite a significant distance, and the cumulative flux across each of those was approximately the same over time. What that says is that the assimilative capacity of the aquifer was negligible. That's very powerful information if you were going to design a remediation strategy, because you want to knock down that flux. 3-11 just showed that a continuation of this process. So 3-12 I'm just summarizing the types of sensors and applications that exist. As I mentioned, we can, and as Greg covered as well, the current sensors that are available can quantify TCE, hexavalent chromium, actually carbon tet, I should have added, some nitrogen explosives, the strontium 90. Greg's got a very robust nitrate sensor that is going to be demonstrated by EPA in the coming weeks. We can get some geochemical parameters, water levels, some vapor chemistry, pressure, etc. There are many future sensors that are in the works. Some may be close enough to implement within the next several months. I'm extremely excited. It's interesting to note, and I think many people could testify that, or at least acknowledge that, a lot of the technologies that we have today in the environmental field came from the oil patch. Well, what we're seeing is a lot of attention on homeland security, in particular sensor development. And I believe that our next gold mine, if you will, of trips and technologies will come from the developments that are born through the efforts to increase our security. And so we're going to see more types of sensors, and we're going to see more types of applications as a result of that. I'm aware of several types of vapor monitoring sensors, new organic sensors, perchlorates on the way. You can do on-the-fly model updates. We've had requests for landfill monitoring and have done some of that already. Hydraulic containment, even simple things like basin storage tracking. A lot of people are now trying to route storm water into aquifer. In fact, there's financial incentive for people to do so, but we can automatically quantify that. So there's a lot of tremendous benefit for merging these types of tools we're talking about. 313, some more encouraging developments. As I mentioned, these sensors are available and under development. There are also some new compatible technologies. Many people have probably been following some of the new concepts that are coming out of some leading universities and industrial players, SmartDesk, MOTS, Crossbow, etc. And there have been more and more statements of need for sensors and approaches coming from the Department of Defense, Energy, Homeland Security, EPA, and elsewhere. And another nice development is that telecommunications and database standards are pervasive now. And I think it's going to become more and more streamlined so that it'll be quite easy to exchange different types of hardware components with software components. 314, because you're getting so much more data as Greg pointed out, you gain a lot of precision, specifically the temporal precision. You can really evaluate the true risks and strategic options. When you're talking about flux, for instance, and you're doing some long-term monitoring, even if it's not a regulatory metric yet, you learn a lot about your plume and a lot about your remediation approach, and could gain insight into optimization if you've got a lot more information. Obviously, to get that information in a conventional way is going to be costly. Again, as Greg pointed out, you can simultaneously monitor multiple sites. So say that you've got several clients, or you've got a client that has multiple sites. You can have everything available through a web browser with a thumbnail representing each site. The nice thing about monitoring at practical time steps is that you might be able to elucidate from your observations dependent variables. Like, show me where TCE is above a certain threshold and the redox potential is below a certain threshold. So when you slice this up temporally, much more refined, you can really come up to some conclusions and maybe even use that for forecasting and modeling. You can also automate your responses. You can integrate this with a PLC or a SCADA system and have your pump sequencing based on in the field observations. 315. So I'd like to just wrap up, and hopefully this was helpful for the folks that have lasted this long. I greatly appreciate it. Single deployment solutions for covering the gamut of the chemical characterization, the hydraulic characterization, the initial modeling, the long-term monitoring network, and the deployment of a long-term monitoring system is now possible. Single deployment solution. The plume architecture becomes the ability to track that and understand that at a very highly resolved level is now possible. There's a new paradigm, and that would be 4D monitoring. I've heard people use that terminology. So you've got three dimensions, but since time now becomes much more resolved, your time steps, then people are referring to this as four-dimensional monitoring. 316, I'd like to express my appreciation to Mike, as well as Gene Ballant and the Triad Community of Practice. CERTIP and ESTCP have obviously helped the industry a tremendous amount. We'd be at least 10 years behind if it wasn't for the efforts of the hardworking folks there. The Naval Facilities Engineering Service Center, I used to work there, and I greatly appreciate their giving me the green light to work on some of these tremendous projects. And this is a short list of some of my heroes here. For field and technical support, there have been many other people that have helped along the way, and I greatly appreciate it and hope that we can continue to work on pushing the envelope as far as possible. 317, thank you all very much, and I'd be happy to answer additional questions, and if you need to get a hold of me, please feel free to do so.
Thanks, Mark. Just keep in mind that people streaming audio are on a few second delay here, so we might get a few questions that come in through text. I do have one that you might be able to answer, but I think is directed more towards Greg's presentation, and it's about sensors.
Okay, I'm here.
The question is, it appears that most sensors can only monitor for one constituent. Is this the case, and what about contamination plumes that have multiple constituents of concern? How can a sensor system address this?
Well, there are multi-parameter sensors out there that can measure a couple of different parameters. It's very difficult to get sensors designed and developed for long-term deployment. You know, take a dissolved oxygen sensor, for example, that can stand up for a year in a well without calibration. Those are typically 2 inches in diameter, some of them that are optical based. So but folks are trying to condense down into, and I think the approach, at least, you know, state of the art today, folks are going to the multi-parameter type sensors where you're looking at potential proxy type measurements where you're looking at pH, conductivity, dissolved oxygen, let's say a couple specific ions like ORP or maybe nitrate in a 2-inch package. Those kinds of sensors, I think there's more research to do to see if they can be correlated to some of the, some of the contaminants of interest. If you know what your contaminant is, which is what Mark's theory is based on, is that you really need to know concentration. So if you can correlate something like that to concentration, you can update the model and actually get performance monitoring. I don't know that you necessarily need to monitor everything. Again, you've got sampling capabilities to do that, to profile. But, you know, there were some folks I know that had done quite a bit of research with Browning Ferris to look at leachate footprints and fingerprints based on, let's say, conductivity, ORP, and dissolved oxygen type of measurements. And they were able to correlate leachate to those parameters. But folks really never implemented, let's say, alarming technology based off of those kinds of parameters. Probably didn't exactly answer that question, but I think the answer is if you were to make a sensor for every single one of those parameters, it would be very expensive that you might get from a sampling event.
Okay. Well, we do have some more time for a Q&A here. I'd like to remind people that on the last slide of the presentation, we have links to both the feedback form, which we'd like you to fill out, and to links that pertain to for more resources pertaining to today's seminar. And I'd also like to remind people that a presentation for Cluin that that Mark did covering the high-resolution PISA cone is now available in the Cluin Studio archive, both the slides and the audio portion of the presentation. Are there any questions for people, for either Mark or Greg, from people on the phone lines? Well, if there's no more questions, you do have the contact information if you wish to reach and ask more questions of the presenters today. I'd like, on behalf of the Cluin Studio and the Technology Innovation Program, I'd like to thank today's speakers. I appreciate the information that you've presented to us all. And I'll thank all the participants for participating today, and hope we can do this again. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.